ran a fan site on the internet.
It's October 28th, 2009.
And this is Idle Thumbs 49, and I'm Chris Remo.
I'm Nick Brecken.
And I'm Jake Rodkin.
And today we are joined by Max Schaefer of Runic Games, which has just launched Torchlight, their new action RPG.
Hello, everybody.
Hey.
Hey.
Good to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for coming over.
Yeah, thanks.
We appreciate it.
No problem.
So the game, as we're speaking to you, the game's about to come out. By the time people hear this, the game is out. You guys have been working on this for what, almost a year?
Yeah, about 11 months in, starting from scratch. So it's been a quick project.
Yeah. How does it feel to be done?
Tiring. It's tired. Yeah. We're very tired. But no, it feels great. It's really been a lot of fun making this game. Probably the most fun we've had in our game careers, and really happy this day has come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it pretty down to the wire? I mean...
Of course. Yeah. Everything was down to the wire. You know, little changes are being made until the exact last possible moment. You know, we scheduled actually from the beginning a week into the end of our schedule that, like, if any emergency happened, we'd be able to make a quick bug fix at the end during the end of the week. But we just used the entire thing up. We probably did 20 builds.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like, and, you know, I obviously am only speaking from the perspective of someone who is, you know, I read some forums and websites and so on. It seems like the sort of hype curve and awareness curve of this game has really, really increased very sharply towards the end. Like, I see more people talking about this game in the last week than I think I did in the entire lead up. I mean, it all of a sudden, if there's live streams going on and people are...
Yeah, yeah.
That's not meant as an insult.
No, it's just...
we're very happy about that recent development, actually, ourselves.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily planned, but it's been great. The live streams are crazy. It's weird watching your game before it comes out on live streams on the internet, but it's been very cool. I've been very happy so far with the response.
And I guess before we get any further, we should actually talk a little about what this is and who you are. For those who don't already know, you were one of the founders of Condor, which became Blizzard North,
yes,
the company that made Diablo and Diablo II, which...
And the Lord of Destruction.
And Lord of Destruction, of course, the expansion to Diablo II. At least in the case of Nick and myself... Probably spent more time on Diablo 2 than maybe any other game, possibly all other games combined. I would feel fairly, if you added Tetris in there, I'm pretty sure that would be an accurate statement for me.
Yeah.
So you are responsible for a pretty big chunk of my total video
life.
Game time.
Yep.
Sadly, that too.
That's that's me too. Nice. I'm with you on that one. So.
There you go. That's somewhat comforting, I suppose.
Yeah.
And Torchlight is a game in that style.
Yes.
A style that, for whatever reason, is less prolific than you'd think it would be, maybe, considering how successful the Diablo games are.
Sure.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's one of these things where it's easy to play and everything kind of just falls to your hand naturally. And it's really hard to do that. You know, you'd think, well, it's easy to play. It must be easy to make. But it's kind of an inverse relationship. So, it's time consuming to make a good hack and slash RPG because you got to have that feel. You got to have a deep loot game. You got to have good animations. It's just a lot of work. There's no easy. It's not. I mean, if we were only so clever as to make Tetris, you know, we could have done it in an afternoon. But,
right. Yeah. Well, that's like the even further extreme of that, right?
Right.
I mean, that game's even simpler to play and it probably requires an even higher sort of just spark of pure creativity where that game's nothing but the mechanic.
Yeah. We throw hard hours at it.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I mean, on that note, you made this game in, what, 11 months?
Yes.
I mean, so that kind of flies in the face of what you just said. How does that work?
Well, you know, we've been doing this since Diablo 1.
Sure,
that's been a long time now, so we're really practiced. And we put a lot of those lessons to work and have really come to the conclusion that good tools makes good development. And I think we've done a really good job with Torchlight of making a tool set that makes the level guys happy, the animators happy, the particle guys happy, the quest makers happy. All, you know, it's something that really makes it easy to make and pleasurable to make a game. And so we've kind of put, you know, all of our experience over the past 15 years into that. And we've got it down to a tidy 11 months now, apparently.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, and I don't know how interesting this is to necessarily everyone, but you guys started with an open source engine, right?
The
Ogre 3D?
And it's virtually unmodified even to this day. It's a graphics engine. I'll just throw polys on the screen, but it does it exceptionally well. And it's been really, really good to work with. So we've just built a giant tool suite around that. And and that's Torchlight, and yeah. came out pretty good. I think Ogre got it's you know it's open source, so it's got a community helping develop it, and I think it kind of quietly got really good, and no one really noticed.
Yeah,
us.
No, it's interesting. I that seems to happen sometimes. I mean, Unity kind of had a similar thing where all of a sudden everyone's talking about it now. But yeah. I mean, how did you guys? I don't know. Let's see. I mean, had you worked with it before? Or what was the, I mean?
No, we kind of just were looking about. You know, we wanted to get a head start and not. We you know after Flagship closed down, we were left to start from scratch with no technology. And so we were really just looking for something to give us a head start and shave some months off the project and, you know, looked at the various gaming packages and licenses and kind of stumbled across Ogre, you know.
This one costs $0.
I didn't want to say that. But yeah, it's the best $0 we've ever spent for
nice.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Worked really well. It's really compatible. You know, it's made our lives a lot easier. That's all you're looking for. So.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And those tools will be made available to everybody.
Right? Yes, the tools we've made, the tool suite we've made is really one unified tool that does everything, is going to be very, very, very soon up for download on your favorite download site. Yeah, free, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is the whole tool set. It's not, we didn't dumb it down for the consumers. We didn't disable it so that people couldn't do things we did. It really is what we use every day. Wholesale. We didn't really have time to change it much. So,
yeah, I saw it a little bit at PAX, and it's interesting. You guys have sort of the visual scripting system. It's sort of reminiscent of what Unreal Engine 3 has with Kismet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Very
it's,
nice.
It's really, that's kind of, it's made for some of the biggest gameplay differences, I think, from the Diablo series is we can really set up little events and, you know, spiders crawling out of cracks when you run into a room or goblins coming out of mine shafts. You know, it's really made made for some neat gameplay differences and some cool encounters that you come across just using the scripting system as well as all the quests and all the other things that happen, secret doors and et cetera.
Sure.
That'll be available obviously in the tool and people can make their own cool events and happenings.
Right. Yeah. So we got a bunch of questions that we'll ask whenever we ask them, but the one question you guys probably have gotten more often and the one that many people sent us is why is this game single player only?
Okay. That, yeah, obviously that's the biggest question we get. What, sure. And first and foremost, it's a matter of time and budget. It increases the complexity a lot to include LAN play. And, I'm not sure that LAN play alone would be accepted by consumers because then they'd say, well, why don't we have a secure environment in which to play multiplayer with people all over the world? And, and that increases the complexity another order of magnitude. And pretty sure soon we're talking about a 3-year deal and not a 11-month deal. And people would have 2 years to wait. So we figured it doesn't take that much. We are going to the MMO. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. So it doesn't take that much time to just do a single player version first and get everything proven, get the IP out there and make it simple. Single player version means also we can release the tools. So you're not going to get, you know, no one's going to get cheated. It's a single player game. So it let us do that. Whereas that becomes more problematic when you're getting to multiplayer. So, you know, it just seemed like the right thing to do.
Yeah. And not to sound like an apologist, but, have to say, having played through, I think I'm getting close to the end of the game at this point. Having played through it, and I, you know, I'm certainly among those who would say, in an ideal world, it would be nice if this were a multiplayer game. But it's been interesting playing it single player. I haven't played a game like this single player since Diablo 1, basically, which I played before I had a remotely decent internet connection. And it's been interesting playing it that way because it does make it almost a totally different game. I mean, Diablo 2. Was more almost of a like a sort of social exercise. Mm-hmm. I loved the narrative flow of that game and all that kind of thing. But it does become sort of minimized in the face of, you know, doing the same quest 18 times because your friend comes in and he hasn't done that one yet, and you both have to do it. And it's great. I mean, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. But it has been nice, kind of being forced, I guess, for lack of a better word, to experience this playing the game in that light.
Sure.
And so I don't know. I kind of feel like that it's. I don't know. I'm hoping people don't because I
no. I feel the same way about it. It also I don't know. Sort of lends it a more casual tone in the sense that it's a game that I feel like is very low investment. You know, I can just jump into it and just sort of run through a couple of dungeons and not feel like I have to. You know,
you don't have to get your crew together.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And you know, and it isn't either or. You know, we are making the MMO,
right?
And we're getting to that. Sure. You know, it's just we're starting with this. And there is something about a single player game too when you're not dealing with a connection to other players that. Just makes it a little bit snappier. You know, you don't have the even the, you know, whatever latency.
Yeah, someone's not jumping around the screen.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's been really good. I'm curious how you guys ended up with the look that you have in this game, which is a much all the stuff that everyone says about Diablo 3.
Yeah.
Your game is sort of a little more of actually what they're saying about Diablo 3. You know what I mean? It's more colorful. It's a little more exaggerated proportion. I think it works quite well. But I'm curious, as the guys who made Diablo 1, which was probably of all those games the darkest and the most gothic, and the, you know,
yeah, people, naked bodies impaled on stakes,
right? Exactly. The butcher.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, if this were Diablo 3, as a Diablo fan, I might be, disappointed in the stylistic turn too, just because of the expectations of the first Diablos. You know,
is it weird to say as a Diablo fan? Like, this is the first Diablo game being made that you haven't made.
Yeah, it's the first time I get to be the fan and anticipate it. Yeah, so, I mean, it wouldn't really be appropriate for that, but that doesn't mean that it's not an appropriate art style for new games and different styles. It's not Diablo, you know, it's Torchlight, and it looks cool, and it's fun, and, you know, you get into the characters and the world, you know, on its own merits.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
And also, one of our things was we didn't want to be super realistic because we wanted to aim for a game that runs smoothly on everyone's machines. And so we didn't want to have the fancy shaders and all the technological things that increase your production time and budgets and tax people's machines sometimes beyond the ability to play. So we wanted to, you know, pick an art style that was compatible with making a fairly low-tech game. And to our art director Jason Beck's credit, you know, it looks fantastic, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It does look really good. And I think it, you know, it benefits by being – it's not a first-person shooter. You're zoomed out fairly far. And also, if you're playing on a PC, obviously you can just have the resolution as high as you want, and it sort of just inherently – looks nicer, but you actually have a netbook mode. Does that actually work on a netbook for real?
Yes. Now, it's not
I wanted to test this, but my netbook got stolen, so I can't.
I wouldn't say that it was something that I'd want to be showing at PAX to thousands of passersby as a representative, but it does play. You'd certainly be able to go on the airplane and play your Torchlight, you know, and that sort of thing. And it does play. And you know, it's not the smoothest, but it's fully playable, and it's still fun.
Yeah, fair enough.
Cool. Yeah, no, I like that it's netbook mode and not very low or something like that.
You don't want to condescend to
them. Yeah.
It's a special mode just for you. Right. We made it just for you.
Right. It was called the worst mode.
Yeah, it's been interesting playing this game because it has I don't really know. I mean, you know, like I said when we started this interview, there are relatively few games that come out in the style. I mean, you guys were working on Mythos before this at Flagship, and then Fate, obviously by Travis Baldry, and then there's been like Titan Quest, and maybe you put Sacred in there. I don't know, but it's weird how few there are, and it's amazing how refreshing it feels, I guess, just to be in there doing it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's because WoW makes so damn much money that. You know, people want to
bother.
Chase that.
Like,
just go after that. You know?
Yeah, that's fair enough. But going back to, well, I guess you guys are making an MMO too now, so.
Yeah, but we're going to keep it in the Torchlight style. It'll be the point and click, and it'll look and feel like Torchlight.
Yeah. And I do want to get into that in a little bit, but one thing I'm curious about actually is, if you don't mind going back in time, I guess, a little bit to some of the Blizzard North stuff. I'm curious where Diablo came from. You know, when we talked about sort of why these games are maybe hard to make or what have you, but I mean, and people often talk about Diablo as a roguelike, but it's sort of its own genre. You know, I mean, with first person shooters, they made Doom, but every single game now isn't compared to Doom, right? I mean, you can make an RPG, but not every RPG is compared to Wizardry or Ultima or whatever. I mean, you cannot make a game in this style without people saying, well, it's not as good as Diablo or whatever. I mean, you can't.
Yeah, I don't, certainly graphically, we weren't copying anything when we made Diablo. I'd say structurally we were copying even like little text-based RPGs like Angband and Moria and things like that from the super old school. They had the random dungeons and loot and stuff. But we really wanted to make a game for that we wanted to play that we didn't feel like people were making. RPGs at the time had kind of devolved into very text-heavy, story-laden, kind of super niche affairs. And really, we just wanted to hit skeletons with clubs and have an item pop off, you know, and use the new graphics powers of computers to display that in all the glory that we could. And so that was really the main impetus for it is to, you know, use that addictive structure of these old text-based RPGs and apply some cool-looking graphics to it and get right to the monster killing. You know, that was one of the mandates from day one is, you know, you fire up the game and within a minute or two, you better be hitting a skeleton with a club and finding a cool sword.
Yeah. There you go. That's, I mean, that's fairly straightforward. Yeah. All right. Well, cool. That you did it. Good job. I definitely achieved that action many, many times.
Yes.
Nick, you're going to say something?
No. I mean, it's something I can we can bring up later. I don't want to.
I think it's time right now.
Do it.
Well, no. I was just in MMO stuff. We should move on.
Oh, okay. Sure. Stuff, sure. Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, I mean, and then going, you know, obviously going back to that time, Nick did an interview recently with Matt Ullman, the composer on Diablo and Diablo 2 and on Torchlight as well. Obviously the, I guess, lead designer on this game is Travis. Is that the case?
Yeah, I don't know what your structure is. We don't really have a title like that, but yeah, sure. it'd be fair to say that he's captains the ship.
Got it. Yeah. But you guys do have a fair number of people from the Blizzard North days, as far as I'm aware. And Matt Ullman's sort of one of the most, I think, visible or audible, I guess.
He was maybe our second or third employee at Blizzard.
Oh, was he really?
At Condor, you know, back in the day, yeah.
Like beyond the principals?
Yeah. So he's very old school for us, yeah, for sure.
It's what's it like sort of making a game where he's handling that again? I mean, it's got to be kind of cool.
It's great, yeah. I mean, when it was just a good convergence of opportunity that he was looking for something when we were looking for sound, and it was great to get the band back together. It kind of feels like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, talking about the Diablo and how much time I spent in those goddamn games over the years, I think one of the – if there's anything that I think – I grew up a PC gamer, primarily. And so, you know, I have experiences that come from that side going back, but I think there are probably very, very few experiences that, PC gamers share more than the guitar chords at the beginning of Diablo. I mean, I don't know. It's
they're seared into our soul.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think everyone uses the phrase seared into my mind, burned into my mind, seared into my brain, like whatever.
Yeah.
You hear that everywhere. Do you feel at all when you're working with him on this to like you don't want to just have that again, but you still
of course
want
we want to have that
sure,
again.
Well, you want to have that reaction again, right? But I mean, you don't want to just feel like you're milking the. Oh, maybe you do. I don't know.
It's Matt Ullman music, you know, and it's. Sure, I think he's done a great job in the game here, and I think in some ways we use it better than we did in the past.
In what sense?
You know, situationally, like you know, with boss battles coming up, getting special you know music things, and when you beat the boss, you get a special music. You know, so I think that we've kind of matched it with what's going on, at least as well or better than we have in the past. And if we can get a signature, you know, thing that's seared into our mind out of it, all the better.
Branded into your calf.
Yeah. Your new body part.
It's like, you know, it's like that, but it's
permanently
you know,
burned somehow. Yeah. It's got to be burning into a body part.
Yes.
That seems actually more of a Diablo thing.
Right.
Burning something into a calf. Yeah. That's maybe a little more Diablo than Torchlight.
Sort of wrought iron prod.
Right. Exactly.
Nick and I were, before you guys got here, Nick and I were talking about the music, particularly in the town, which my assumption is Matt probably spent more time on that than he did any other music in the game, because that is going to be the moment when everyone comes in and your brain starts making that, that kind of muscle memory type association.
Definitely.
But it is interesting. There are a couple moments in there where it's almost directly lifted from Diablo, but then it kind of veers off. It almost, like the way I was describing it and the way
we want to pick you up where you're comfortable, you know, and take you into crazy
Well,
places.
It feels to me like this was music born out of kind of the same, like, fictional setting as Diablo, except this is sort of the more rousing adventure or, like, fairy tale version of it, whereas Diablo was kind of the version where everyone dies, you know?
Right,
like
that
was, like, the sort of, sort of, like, dirge, right? Whereas this one is
a little more triumphant sounds
and
refrains for sure.
But it was interesting, particularly with that track. It really felt like a pretty amazing kind of divergence from that while still
being familiar.
So good job there.
Like, oh, here we go again. Yeah, good job, Matt, for sure. Yeah.
Our this is probably sounds disgusting. I'm just like slobbering all over your game, but I'm really enjoying it. I was up till like 5 a.m. on Friday night or something playing this stupid thing. So
nice. Me too.
Good to hear.
You know, I don't really feel bad about it. Like, if more people buy this game because
you sacrifice for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. My sleep schedule has been terrible now. So,
although there are a couple things I'd like to ask about, because there are a couple things I feel I either maybe don't understand or maybe are like unbalanced a bit. One of the things I'm curious about is in the game, I'm playing as the alchemist right now, which is the sort of, I guess, the ostensibly magic casting class, although he's not necessarily called, you know, the wizard or what
right.
have you.
Right, with a twist. Yeah.
Sure. But I'm finding that at this point, I have a gun that I've been using for a while that all I'm doing basically is pumping enchantments into when I go back to town mm-hmm. to the point where this gun basically rips the shit out of any offensive spell I could yeah. possibly cast. It feels like you guys tuned this game much more around offensive weapons than you did offensive spells. Is that the case?
Well, you know, we don't want to take the loot game away. I think that in any RPG, you risk taking the loot game away from the magic user just because it becomes all about spells and skills, and that kind of takes away a lot of the fun. So, you know, hopefully you're using some spells and skills to augment your blasting with your gun. And if so, then we're okay still.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it's a desire to keep a loot game and keep people interested in opening chests and finding items and enchanting them and doing all that.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it does seem like this game has actually more loot in it than Diablo does. Like, it seems like the rate of item drops, at least that I've experienced, is actually even higher, which is fun. I like it. I mean, I actually like stopping every 5 minutes and comparing everything I picked up to everything I'm wearing. Right. Like that's not actually a negative. But it does seem like I guess one of the other questions I was going to ask in sort of as a tale of this, do you guys see yourself doing any post-release like balance or tweaking? Obviously you have the mod tools and people will be free to do whatever they want with those.
I think we're going to be replacing the notion of the patch with just mods just like everyone else is making. Cause you know, we'll be using the same tool to do it as everyone else. We're going to generate the same kind of files as everyone else. So why not?
But you'll actually release stuff yourself?
In all likelihood we will. Yeah. I probably just at first, at least on a super casual basis, like I was like, sure. Oh my God, we blew it. We made the guns too powerful for the alchemists, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
we'll nerf your guns and you'll have the option of installing that or not.
Sure. No, I mean, I think it is part of it is that there in this game, as compared to Diablo, in Diablo, there are class specific weapons. Right. Where in this game there aren't. I mean, there's sort of like the flavor of it is.
Yeah. And there's some stat preferences for, you know.
Sure.
But yeah, it's again, we wanted it to be so that more than one out of every three weapons was even eligible to be cool for you. Yeah.
Mm.
That sort of thing again. Yeah. Sure. Just keeping it open.
Yeah. Mm. I'm curious about the, because obviously, you know, that's, as we were saying, this is a single player game. Mm. You guys are working in the MMO. I'm curious what that actually means. Like when you say this will be an MMO, I don't actually know. Like, is it? I can imagine a few things. I mean, I could imagine a Diablo 2 style thing, which is kind of the least MMO option. I could imagine a Guild Wars, mm-hmm. right? You could imagine the World of Warcraft. I mean,
I think probably more like Mythos, if you remember the way Mythos was heading.
I actually didn't play as much Mythos. I played maybe a couple hours.
So I would say it would have the social structure of a WoW, mm-hmm. But. The gameplay, the camera angle and controls and gameplay style of the single player game. So it will look a lot like the single player game, but you will travel over land areas and go from town to town and see all kinds of other people running around and form parties and guilds and, you know, all that's PvP and all that sort of fun stuff. But it'll all be at the, you know, with the gameplay look and feel of the single player game.
But I mean, do you see it being heavily instanced or?
Yeah, how are you approaching the level design?
Definitely a mix. Usually the overland areas are shared giant, you know, acreage areas. And then with dungeons, it's really technologically trivial to distinguish between something that is made for an instance just for your party or something that can be shared by, you know, the first 32 people that go in, the first 200 people that go in, you know, it's really just a matter of the design of the dungeon and why you're there and what kind of place it is and what you want the experience to be for the player. So it'll be a mix of shared things, instanced, you know, kind of larger instance, like maybe at every 100 people you regenerate a new dungeon, it becomes an instance. But who knows, you know, it's just a matter of what cool things our level designers make and what seems fun while we're playing it.
Sure. I mean, are you guys going to be staffing up for that? I mean, as I recall, you're a pretty small team right now.
And we're going to stay for MMO standards. We're going to stay small, mm-hmm. But we're going to aim for efficiency and you know, and good tools again.
Yeah,
you know, get to work on a terrain editor like right away.
Oh, right.
You know, fill in the gaps of what we don't have that's appropriate for MMO making. But we will staff up some too, for sure. Right. For sure.
I mean, so this is set in the Torchlight. We're like. Presumably the Ember influence spreads or something.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that.
Outdoor and everything, is it?
Yeah. And there'll be more towns. And, you know, the Torchlight is the town.
Right.
And there will be, you know, different towns and obviously much bigger storylines. And so we'll extend the story, but it'll be in the world of Torchlight. Yeah.
And the plan is free to play as a financial model? Is that
correct?
Is that
free to play, free download, and we will sell optional things that you can buy that are going to be so compellingly cool that you'll want to.
All right.
But not so cool that it ruins the game for the free players.
Yeah, right.
It's a balance there.
Tough line to walk.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, do you think that's something that, I mean, it's still something that I don't know if it's been fully proven in the West, right? I mean, we know it's super successful in Korea, in China.
Yep.
Do you think people here understand that yet?
I'm still not sure how
I feel about it personally, which is one reason I ask.
I think that, you know, there's no great way to get people to pay for the cost of making these games. but this one, in our opinion, is kind of the best because it lets you select like the way you want to be involved with the game. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to just play it and you know, you don't have a lot of money, you can do that. And if you want maybe to level a little faster and, you know, have things be a little more convenient and you have some money, you can do that. And, you know, we're trying to make cool things. Like I say, to buy, like in Mythos, we had a great idea for an item, which was a map to a dungeon. And this particular dungeon would have slightly better loot drops and maybe experience gain than the regular one that you would go to. And you would buy a map and you could bring your whole party with you. So even the guys that didn't play can go and enjoy the benefits of this thing.
Right.
And you still have to kill the monsters and you still have to be lucky enough to find stuff, but there's just a little bit better loot drops in there, you know, and that's something that doesn't make it unfair or anything. And it's something that people who can't pay, it's not like they're shut out of it. You just got to be partied with someone who can.
Right.
And, you know, it just seems like one of those sensible things. And you go to the dungeon, it's an instance, and you leave, and it's done, and you have to buy another map to do another one. So it just seems like one of those things that works for this sort of model. You just got to convince one guy in your party to buy it.
Yeah. Have you guys done much, like, hard design of this yet? I mean, do you have kind of, like, specs? I mean, what...
No, we've done design on it and we have ideas of where we want to take it and what we want to do. But we've really been concentrating on making this single player version right now. We've been doing more technological back end work.
Sure.
Than we have just straight game design at this point.
I mean, do you guys, I don't know how much you can say about this, but I mean, do you guys have kind of internal targets for kind of what you feel Torchlight needs to do commercially and kind of any sense of how that's going? I mean, obviously, I'm not asking for numbers.
Yeah,
but.
No. It's sort of experimental for us. You know, this is the first time we've done a straight single player game on the PC ever. It's the first time we've done a straight digital download game. It's the first time we've released tools and done $20 thing or something. So there's a lot of variables there that we just figure that if it's cool enough, a lot of people will buy it and things will work out for themselves in the end.
Yeah,
and that's what we're hoping for. We have no idea how it's going to do.
I'm curious just because, and anyone who listens to this podcast obviously knows we talk about PC stuff a lot, but in addition to obviously I want people to buy this game because I think it's really good and I genuinely hope it succeeds on those merits. I am curious to see how it does as what I see as kind of a mid-range PC game, which has always been my greatest interest as a gamer, right? I mean, I love the super indie stuff on the PC. I love, you know, big budget stuff on whatever. I mean, I play a whole lot of games, but I've always, for whatever reason, for the most part, been most interested in the stuff on the PC that comes in the middle, where you've got a team that's small enough that you can still call it a small team, right? But you're still doing stuff that isn't purely just two guys, like in a basement. It's like, that stuff's great too. I just mean... there is a nice middle ground. I
think that's what we were going for, definitely, with this project, is kind of having the good balance of an intimate team that everyone, like, we don't have even cubicles in the office. They're just desks. And so you just, like, turn around and holler at someone.
Sure.
So it's small enough that, you know, you can get that real team, atmosphere, but big enough that you can get good production values and have something that, you know, it's going to hold your interest for more than just a week or so.
Yeah. Right. I'm curious to see how it works out because I feel like that's been less, less represented.
Yeah.
Recently, like it seems like the way that risk averse publishing has gone, you've kind of have to be one or the other, like on the extreme, right? I mean, you've got to convince some publisher that it's worth spending however many tens of millions on your game, or you've got to do something where you can like make it in your spare time or whatever, right? It's
right.
I don't know. I'm
with you. I think it's underrepresented. I think it's where you can do some of the cooler things too, because you can make a game that's complex enough to be a real game, and you know, keep it cheap enough that it's not going to break the bank of the publisher and be too risky for him.
I mean, why do you think that that's become less common, less noticeable?
I think everyone's going for the WoW killer, you know, going for the WoW money still, you know, the giant mega hit, you know, that's where the huge money is, I guess. But it seems to, you know, it seems to us that this is an underrepresented area, and that's kind of what we've, you know, made our career on, is look for what people aren't doing that would be really cool and trying it.
Do you find that services like Steam, I mean, do you feel like you guys are getting more visibility by being on stuff like Steam? I mean, do you get any tangible sense of that?
Oh, definitely. I think that, you know, a lot of people are going to Steam these days, and we're up there for pre-order. You know, they got our ad running through the rotation, and, you know, it's I think it's great. Yeah. I think it's a great way to buy games.
So you're not being exploited by the...
Oh, heavens no. Oh, my goodness. No, we do so much better with a download on anyone's site than you do for a box as an indie developer that, you know, it's great for us. It's way, you know, it's great.
Yeah. Are you guys planning on putting it in a box at some
point? Oh, absolutely. You know, that's a huge market too. You know, to be in a Walmart and be a, you know, Christmas purchase, although we're putting it out in January, which defeats that idea.
Well, you know, but you know, January is the new desire. I guess quarter one is the new Christmas night. Yeah.
Exactly. Get those return shoppers.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So yeah, we will be out in the boxes coming in January, and you know, should be good.
Cool. You guys want to move on to some questions, Nick? I don't know if you have anything. I'm sorry, I've been kind of
dominating
this.
Well, yeah. Questions are good. Right. I'll spit my stuff off on questions.
Fair enough.
And I'll just continue to sit here.
All right. Let's see. We got a bunch of questions. I will just kind of go through. And some people sent like 800 in their email. So I'll see if I can just pick a couple. But let's see. So a question for Mr. Schaefer from Game Dreamer. This looks kind of long, but I guess we'll go for it. Mm-hmm. Some of my fondest gaming memories involve coming home from school, throwing my backpack on the floor, and jumping onto my computer chair to log into Battle.net. When I was logging in, I would grab a pop soda for all you non-Ohio weirdos from the fridge, turn off the lights, and get lost in Diablo 2. Okay, this is going to be long. An hour later, two of my friends would be online, and we'd dungeon crawl for literally the entire night. The next morning, I'd realize I didn't finish any homework, but I didn't care. It was worth it. I kept a little notebook among my class binders with notes that I jotted down the previous night about Diablo and how to beat certain dudes or where the best drop locations were, etc. And I would doodle things like weapons and characters, enemies, and of course, cows jumping through portals or exploding. I guess I don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you, Max, for being involved in the development. Okay. There you go. Development of a game that brought me immense joy and really sparked my imagination. Yeah. It has kind of helped me shape myself into the person I am artistically. I'm sure many people will tell you the same thing. It amazes me how Diablo 2 holds up today, and while I don't think about it 24/7 anymore, there are still times every couple of months when I get a really strong urge to start a new character and do it all over again. Take care, thumbs. All right, well, there you go.
Yeah.
That wasn't a question, but
no, that's great.
I think that was worth reading.
Great. That sounds like the sort of people that work in our office.
There you go. All right. So, Swarren, a question for Max Schaefer. To be honest, I'd almost forgotten about this game until Idle Thumbs brought it up due to support, and I'm now excited, and I've decided to purchase it off Steam. I'm excited about the editor, and I plan on using it. Anyway, wanted to ask, is the idea of designing it into an MMO maybe too late at this point? I look at where other games are at this point, Diablo 3 being one of them, and I wonder if you can reach audiences at a time when they would still be interested. I also wanted to ask, since Flagship is in the past now, could you maybe get into the situation of Hellgate London? Did you have any worries about it before it was released? Also, any thoughts on Bill Roper, having worked with them for a while? Signed, Swarren. This guy's going straight for the...
Yeah. Let's take them in reverse order.
Sure.
Because I only remember the last two.
Okay.
Bill Roper's awesome, great friend, and it was wonderful working with him, and wouldn't hesitate to do so again in the future. Hellgate London, obviously we worried about it. It needed more time, and we ran out of money. Very short story. That's the way it went. the first question was...
This was actually something I meant to ask, and then I forgot. Okay. But it was basically, are you worried that your game's going to be coming out like when Diablo 3 is, and you're going to have trouble breaking through that wall?
Is that when Diablo 3 is coming out?
We don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. It's kind of hard to work around that because, you know, you never know where, when and where. But yeah, I mean, hopefully we've created a universe and a world that's compelling enough that people will be interested in its own right. You know, obviously I'll buy Diablo 3 too, but you know, part of the whole idea of, again, going back to the free to play, free download is that you're not stuck into one game. You know, you can play however many you want.
That's true.
The action RPG world is big enough for the both of us.
Fair enough. Clayton Hughes writes, all right, this is probably a decent question considering Nick and I are didn't do this at all, and Jake didn't say anything. I understand that by revealing this, I own up to sucking at having played good video games, but as I am someone who's only played a few hours of the first Diablo and none of the second, why does Max think I should care about Torchlight? How will it blow me away? It's getting some buzz, so I recognize the name, but for the most part, I don't know. Keep casting those pods, Clayton. So what would you say to those people?
To me.
Oh, yeah. To Jake. Yeah. Convince Jake, whose name is on this podcast informally video games, yeah. Erroneously. So,
yeah. Well, I don't know. I guess we've spent 15 years trying to make this sort of thing fun. So hopefully it's just, you know, it's just plain fun when you do try it. Obviously, one of the things we've done is make it $20. So your risk is lower than the $60 box that you play twice and don't want to ever play again.
Sure.
And in case we've gotten anything or everything horribly wrong, we've released the tools so that our community can fix it.
There you go.
So, you know, but basically, hopefully it's just, you know, we've crafted a game and a bunch of skills and a bunch of characters and a bunch of environments that we think are really fun to play in. So hopefully that carries it.
Drew writes, please ask Mr. Schaefer if he's excited that in the future game previewers or reviewers might be able to talk about Runic Games, the company that made Torchlight, instead of Runic Games, the company made up of now defunct Flagship Studios people, Hellgate London snarky comment, cartoon Diablo. So you have a game out.
That would be great. It can't come soon enough.
Yeah.
So Mike has some questions that are about really specific gameplay things that people probably know by now that the game's out, but well, whatever. Can I really trust my pets to sell the items at the store, or is there a chance of them using the money they get to purchase catnip? Will there be a way to tell if they are embezzling my money? Something like seeing them wearing an Armani collar, which I never bought for them, or maybe they'll drop a card to a 5-star restaurant I've never heard of before. Mike Alonso. Are the pets trustworthy?
You know, as far as we know, they're trustworthy.
All right.
But being an animal, you know, they're slightly unpredictable.
But now that idea is out there, hopefully someone will...
There'll be a mod.
There's a mod.
And devious cat
pets.
Mod. Yeah. Oh,
that's what the internet likes.
Yes. My pet is embezzling.
Right. That's awesome. That would be kind of amazing.
That actually would be good.
You've got like an economic system in the MMO and
you can't trust
bust
them.
Into that.
Like,
I mean, didn't you want
a roll if your pet turns dirty?
Need a lawyer NPC or something.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, well, Ian O'Dedelic, I guess, has an observation you kind of already stated. He says, it seems Hellgate failed because you wanted to do everything, MMO, DLC, multiplayer, first-person shooter within a small time frame. It looked like you were too ambitious. With Torchlight, you seem more humble, doing the things you do best and then expanding to other places. Is that why it doesn't have multiplayer? I don't mind not having multiplayer now, as we all played Diablo 1 solo and loved it. Bye, best wishes to all wizards and space assholes. So, sounds like that's basically what you said.
Yeah, pretty much.
Except for the part about wizards and space assholes.
A question for Max. He asks some stuff other people already asked, and then he says, also, did you know the Schaefer surname comes from the Middle High German Schaefer, meaning shepherd? Say hello to your brother Tim. Sorry, Glenn. did you know that?
I did know that.
All right.
Shepherd.
Well, there you go.
Schaefer. And further Schaefer trivia.
Yeah.
The AE, from what I understand, is the English spelling for the use of the A with an umlaut.
Ah, right.
And so we were that close to having an umlaut in our name, and that would have
been
so heavy metal.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Too bad.
Yeah.
You could always change it back.
Yeah. Too hard to type.
Let's see. A lot of people are asking the same questions again, so I'm going to skip these. Oh, here. This is kind of interesting. Question for Max Schaefer. Were there any members on the Diablo 1 or Diablo 2 teams who strongly argued against randomly generating the world monsters and items? And if so, what were their reasons? That's from Stefan.
You know, I don't remember anyone arguing against it. I think that there were valid criticisms of it. And I think that to some extent we've addressed them in Torchlight. And that was that if they're too random, then it ends up looking like sort of an extruded, you know, crossword puzzle. And mm-hmm. you don't get the carefully architected and you know, handcrafted look and feel of certain areas. And so that's one of the things we've changed for Torchlight is the random level units are much bigger. We make a level out of 3 or 4 big mega chunks, and there's like 30 or 40 of each of those chunks that we pick from, but the level itself is made up of 3 or 4 of these chunks. So you can set up much more, you know, handcrafted situations and when you're approaching a boss encounter because things look radically different and you know, it doesn't just look like randomly laid out tiles. And within those big chunks, we're still able to do random things. Like you might have a shrine here, you might not, might have a secret door, might have a certain little encounter that you know, monsters come popping out from behind a door or something, and other times it doesn't. So we can build that sort of like, you know, low level randomness into our chunks as well. But by making a map of these big, large chunks, we can make really cool looking handcrafted areas. So hopefully we get most of the benefits of doing, you know, handcrafted levels versus random levels. But yeah, I'd say in the Diablo 1, Diablo 2 times, that was a valid criticism of some of the random areas, and hopefully we've improved that.
Sure. Let's see here. Janny has 800 trillion questions. I'll probably just pick a couple of them. He has some about the MMO. He says, do you plan to improve on the game engine for the MMO with things like physics or destructible terrain, etc.?
Certainly we may do more interaction with the terrain, but we don't want to do too much with physics or anything that would tax machines beyond people's ability to have it be a smooth experience on their kind of, you know, regular day-to-day PCs.
Fair enough. He says, can you shed some light on at least a few things the MMO will have different to Torchlight?
I'd say the biggest thing was, you know, you'll see other people. You know, you have to have a world big enough to fit them. So, you know, we're definitely going to expand beyond the, you know, hub town and dungeons beneath structure of Torchlight. So, you know, immediately you'll notice large overland areas and different towns and large, you know, vast, you know, land that you have to explore. And, you know, so that makes it a little different than, you know, going into a mountain and finding a source of corruption at the bottom of the mountain, you know. So I think that'll be the biggest thing. And again, we want to just keep the feel and flavor, but then make a real MMO world out of it.
How are you approaching the overworld areas? Well, I mean, how are you thinking about it in terms of keeping sort of the immediacy of an action RPG within that sort of, you know, expanded territory? Because one of the problems I have playing MMOs is that there are those periods where you're just walking from one point to another. And sometimes it's interesting, but a lot of the times it's like, ugh, I got to walk across the world. There's nothing going on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely that's a good question, because that's one of the big challenges is we still want to have an MMO that you can play for half an hour before dinner and that sort of thing. And that's very difficult to do if you're spending your whole time just traversing the land. So we will do things like have waypoints and things that get you around the world. You know, it shouldn't be a navigation chore. Just because you have a big world, it doesn't mean it should be a navigation chore. Mm. You know, so. Yeah, you know, it's just going to be a matter of how we design the world. But we got a good practice run at it with Mythos and learned a lot of how you get a lot of people and with this camera angle and this style into a, and you know, what size your areas should be, how far the between towns and that sort of thing works in this sort of construct. So hopefully we can take the lessons from Mythos and apply them here as well.
Cool.
And we've got a good partner and publisher in Perfect World, who's made a lot of really successful MMOs in Asia, and they've got a lot of lessons from that also that they're more than happy to share with us. So.
Do you have any thoughts on what direction you might take the player economy stuff? I just in terms of, you know, the hubs and you know, how player driven you want that to be, how, you know, how much you don't want to confuse the player, or maybe, you know.
I think that you got to have, you know, you got to have trade of items.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have trade of item of items, you may as well make it as easy and flexible as possible so that people aren't struggling to do it, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, we want a vigorous player economy. You know, people be able to sell their items in little shops and, you know, all the things that real MMOs do.
Right.
You know, those are not incompatible with what we're doing at all.
Okay. You guys going to get a Stone of Jordan economy? In the you know what the deal with that was?
That caught us by surprise, too, I have to say.
The whole Stone of Jordan economy in Diablo 2 evolved during one of my breaks from Diablo 2, right? So I came back like a year later or something.
And yeah, that took me by surprise,
like,
too.
What's that?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I've got this, like, you know, this armor or whatever I want to trade. And someone's like, oh, I'll give you two SOJs.
Right.
I'm like, I don't even know what that means.
It's not in the manual. What?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was like incredible. The gold standard or something. I was like, how did that, you know, what, but it was weird. Yeah, that totally caught us by surprise as well. But I think, you know, it economics sort of work themselves out in these games. And, you know, part of the fun is seeing what kind of unpredictable things happen. And that's really a lot of the fun of MMOs is, you know, unintended consequences and the things that happen with the social interactions and the economy, certainly as well. And, yeah, so something about the Stone of Jordan made it a good currency. You know, we should really study that. Actually,
well, I love that stuff about MMOs. Yeah. I mean, I love when it's open enough to be sort of broken a little bit to where things,
you that's know where I mean? The cool stuff happens for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, I personally think a big part of it, even though I think that in that form it was kind of broken and that it basically excluded anyone who didn't either like physically break the game, like dupe stuff, or hadn't been playing for 18 million years. But I think what there is to learn from it, and that I think really interesting, is it really demonstrates how meaningless currency is unless it's relatively fixed. Right. I mean, when you've got gold that anyone can get just by farming monsters forever, you're inherently, we've got essentially a valueless economy. Right. I mean, if it's infinite, it doesn't mean by the time no one trades gold in anything, in an MMO and in Diablo, it's pointless. Anyone can have as much gold as they want if they just spend enough time. Right. But the interesting thing about the SOJ was there was actual real scarcity to it, and it created a semblance of a real world economy. And it would be interesting to say, I mean, I don't know what you guys are going to do, but it'd be interesting to see that kind of thing. I mean, it would give items, I think, real value.
Yeah, definitely. Can we call you later about that?
Please.
Okay.
So, yeah, let's see what else we have here. Let's see. How does it feel? I guess we kind of already touched on this, but I'm so interested in all this stuff that I'm going to ask it again. How does it feel to have other people work on Diablo 3, a franchise that's been such a big part of your professional life? Is it weird somehow? Are you somehow disappointed that they've changed things that the previous team thought was perfect?
Who was?
This is the same guy. This is Janny. Okay, he's just, I'll tell you when we move on because he asks a lot. I'll probably stop asking his questions.
I mean, it's weird and it's kind of cool at the same time because, you know, someone else is doing all the work. and you know, certainly there's a sense that by the time you're finished making a game, you've really immersed yourself in it for so long that you're ready to do something else. And so it's kind of cool to be able to wait and play it like a player when it comes out and see all the cool things they've done. Certainly the fact that Blizzard's making it means that it's going to have great production values and have lots of cool things that lots of cool surprises. And it certainly will be worth your money when it comes out. So it is cool. It's a little weird at the same time because someone else has taken it and they're going to go directions with it that, you know, maybe we wouldn't have, but, you know, again, who knows? And that's what they should do. You know, the team should be making the game that the team thinks is the coolest possible Diablo 3. And I think that's what they're doing. And from little glimpses we've seen, they're doing a great job so far. Yeah. You know? It was definitely weird at PAX, though. You know, you could, from our booth, you could actually kind of see some of the Diablo 3 signs over in the corner.
Right.
And, it's interesting.
Were there any, I remember hearing years ago about, you know, the version of Diablo 3 that Blizzard North was making, mm-hmm. and that it was just, like, intensely crazy and extremely, like, violent or lewd or just, like, I mean, are there any?
That's new. No, it was. No, I don't. No, I don't think so. Wow. No, I didn't expect that.
I forget. Yeah, you heard that too. Yeah.
No, I had.
Oh, you
no,
hadn't.
No one else.
I heard this. I forget who it was who told me this, but
that would have been cool.
It was your dream.
Yeah.
I remember hearing that it was just a very sort of bizarre thing. I don't know.
It may have been bizarre, but we were making. What we thought should be Diablo 3, and I think it was very faithful to Diablo. So it certainly wasn't a radical departure from what had come previously. Obviously, it was 3D, and so that opened up a whole lot of stuff. But that was a long time ago now.
So you left in what, 2003, as I recall?
Yeah, I think it was 2003.
And I guess they've been making it ever since.
Yeah, I guess though, you know, when the team was gutted up in Blizzard North, bringing it down south, sets you back a little.
Right. I think they probably started over a couple times.
Pretty much,
point. Let's see. Oh, how does the here? This is kind of interesting. How does the atmosphere at Runic differ from the one when working on Hellgate and Mythos?
Well, it's the same team that was working on Mythos, so it is a lot the same. You know, it's the same guys, literally. Sure. and it was part of the attractiveness of that working on Mythos for, you know, I did that for a year and a half before we Flagship closed down, and it was great. You know, the size, and it all comes down to size. You know, our Flagship had, you know, over 100 people, and it was a big company, and it's just much more fun, in my opinion, to make a game with a small team. And so it was you know, it was definitely something we wanted to aim for, and restarting out of the ashes is let's go for that, you know, that sweet spot in size, which, you know, in my opinion, is a team, you know, not going too much beyond 40.
Yeah, there you go. How big is Runic?
We're about 26 or 27 right now.
Okay.
And like I say, we'll staff up a little.
Right.
Stay under 40, hopefully.
Sure. I'll probably move on to someone else because that guy still has more questions.
They were good questions, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Um,
thanks, that guy.
Let's see. Or actually, actually, I might actually ask more because I think I put this guy's one last because he asked so many freaking questions. Are you excited about Diablo 3? Do you think they'll send you a free copy? I mean, you've already answered if you're excited, but
I'll trade him a Torchlight.
There you go.
And yes,
and an SOJ.
Yeah.
Right. Let's see. Some of these we already asked, actually. He says, I guess to continue off the previous question, what's a typical day at Runic Games like? I mean, what do you do, for example, on a day-to-day basis?
It changes over the course of a project for me because I deal with a lot of the business angle and relations with the publisher. And now, like I said, when I came in, it's, you know, frantically making sure our licenses are in order and
right.
all the contracts are signed and we can actually start to sell a product. But a typical day in the office is a bunch of guys working really hard. You know, it's a very tight team. Again, it's the size is small enough that you see everyone every day and you talk to everyone every day. And, you know, so it's like one team. It's not groups that are kind of form cliques and things like that. But it's a very unique team in how hard they work. And, I think that certainly Travis is the leader on that. And people look to him as he leads by example, not by yelling or anything like that. And
he shouldn't just yell. Go for it.
Lay into him. And no, he works so darn hard that everyone wants to kind of keep up with him. And it's just a great team to work with. Mm.
I remember this is, again, switching back to Blizzard North, but I was reading, the other day, I don't remember how I found this, but I was reading an article that was in Time magazine from, like, 1999 or something, written by, I guess, a childhood friend of yours, who was describing what the kind of atmosphere was like at Blizzard North at the time leading up to the release of Diablo 2. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that company was largely made up of other childhood friends of yours and just kind of people that you guys had known. And we actually, for people listening to the podcast, Eric, Max's brother, sitting on a couch over, not speaking to him on, so he's here too, but those you two guys started the company along with, is it Dave Brevik?
Dave Brevik, yes.
Yeah, and then, I mean, did you guys just kind of think, let's start a game company? I mean, what?
Yeah, and I mean, it was at a time where you only needed a few guys to make a game, and, we cut our teeth on some Game Boy stuff and Sega Genesis game. It was a Street Fighter clone. Justice League Task Force. And I have nightmares about animating those giant sprites still, pixel by pixel in D-Paint.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Definitely sears into your brain like the Diablo song.
That's a worse, maybe a
yeah,
worse.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, but, it got to the point where we had our little company and all of a sudden we realized someone should probably be keeping some books and keeping track of money and stuff. And so, we call up our
That's
friend
amazing.
Who can
you
do
could,
that.
You could get a publishing deal for a licensed product. And then after that, decide someone should keep. Like, that's so preposterously far from how anything could conceivably work now. That's kind of hilarious to me. Yeah. Like, that you were working with, the DC license?
DC license, like, justly. It was even weirder than that. Our publisher gave us a list of games that we could choose which one we wanted to make.
Uh-huh.
And I think one of them was the Aerosmith game. And
nice.
That was really like an Aerosmith game.
That game came out, right?
Yeah. I think it was like a couple years later that one came out, but it was like, well, what would that be? They said, I don't know, an Aerosmith game.
Well, it was like every other thing. It's a side scroller, and then you go out, right?
Like the Michael Jackson game. Yeah.
Yeah. Scooby Doo was one of the choices, and that would have been kind of cool, but, the Justice League Task Force, like, at least you they knew what they want. You could see the game there and DC license. Yeah, but yeah, now that would be a pretty hot license these days.
Yeah.
Incidentally, making that game was how we met the Blizzard guys because they were tasked by the same publisher to make the Super Nintendo version.
Oh.
And why they had two different teams and they didn't put us in touch at all, so we didn't share any resources between the Genesis and the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, it used to happen a lot.
Yeah, they were both, I mean, they were both like Street Fighter clones basically,
right.
But they looked completely different and had different, and we met them at a Las Vegas CES one year and we're like, hey, you guys are the Nintendo guys.
that's weird.
Yeah, it was totally weird.
Only yours had Matt Ullman. Speaking in the voiceover in the
That's right. Yeah, that was production values, baby.
Yeah.
Man, that's amazing, though. That's an incredible connection. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's how we met the Blizzard guys and ended up, pitching them on our cool new PC idea, which was Diablo.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah,
was Matt was telling me about
coincidence.
An NFL game you guys were working on, too. He said it was pretty ambitious.
We signed to do the Diablo with Blizzard.
Right.
And, you know, bless their hearts, they gave us $300,000 to make Diablo, you know, which was obviously not going to be enough. And so we, you know, we had to fund the company a little bit another way. So we made a football game for 3DO for their upcoming unreleased machine called the M2. And so it was their new machine that was going to come out. And so that was a pretty lucrative contract to make that game. And so we had a few guys working on that and a lot of guys working on Diablo.
Right.
And so we were.
That might still occur
once in a while. Yeah, I can. It's been long enough. I think the statute of limitations is over on that.
Yeah, right.
But no, the football game was actually turning out pretty good. I was working on that actually a lot of the time, and it was coming out pretty good. And I think we heard that 3DO was using it to pitch the machine when they were trying to sell the technology off, which they did successfully. Okay. And that the machine never happened. Again, one of those good coincidences is that right when Blizzard wanted to buy us, 3DO said, we don't want to do this anymore. And so
we have no other responsibilities.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But actually it was pretty fun. I mean, it was coming along pretty well.
Was it basically like a football game? I mean, was it skeleton killer?
No, it was going to be more of a. It wasn't going to be a hardcore simulation football game. It was going to be more a little like a backyard football sort of thing. Yeah, okay, a little more fun to play.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Are you playing anything right now? Or are you just? I mean, I
play Wordle on my iPhone mostly.
Nice. I play that more than anything else on my iPhone. I don't play anything really on my iPhone except that sometimes. Words are fun. Yeah. I'm playing Bookworm Adventures on my PC
and a Sudoku
too.
Once in a while as well. Just got to keep the mind working. Yeah,
sure.
No, but we've been pretty immersed in Torchlight for a while now.
Yeah,
what can't
immersed,
wait to get to
immersed in Torchlight.
Immersed. Yeah,
it sounds nice. It's a good
it
name,
burns,
by the way.
Actually,
what's that?
It burns.
It burns. Right. It burns into you. Yeah. Right. But no, it is a good name. It's there are very
very hard to name a game.
Yeah. No, I mean there are not very many games named well.
Yeah.
I mean Diablo. Also pretty much nailed it. I mean,
it doesn't make any sense at all. Why would you use the, you know, Italian Spanish word for a devil to describe an
it's very
Irish countryside?
Malevolent sounding, right?
It is, yeah. No, it somehow worked out, yeah. Yeah, that was a flash. That was David Brevik's, to his credit. Yeah, he got his best ideas in the shower in the morning, and he came in one day, it's like, we will call it Diablo.
Was that before there was a monster in it called Diablo?
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. So that's the same as Torchlight, right? I mean, Torchlight makes more sense as the name of the game than it does the name of the town, right? It's like, it's worth naming the town that so that you get to name the game.
Yeah, it makes some sense. Exactly. And it was named, the game was named before the town was
I assume that was the case. Yeah, right. Because that speaks so much to the underground kind of just, I don't know. It's a very evocative.
But it was very, I mean, we've had lists of hundreds and hundreds of names that, you know, people in the company were compiling, and we'd vote and we'd get it down to, you know, the final 64, and, you know, we'd whittle it down, and then we didn't use any of those.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Well, that's how it always goes. That one comes in 4 days later. I was like, Torchlight. Oh. Good thing we didn't settle on one of those other names.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of them were taken anyway.
So this is, I want to ask about, this is just me asking random crap that I keep remembering now that I have somebody made Diablo in front of me. In Torchlight, you're using the sort of, Diablo 1-like structure, where you're sort of burrowing down ever further into this like corrupted land, which is a really cool thing. But in Diablo 2, uses an entirely different structure that I find really interesting. And I was wondering if there was someone who sort of conceived this. One of my favorite things Diablo 2 does that almost no other game that I know of does, is the actual surface level plot of the game is not about your character. I mean, it's about another character that you are following in parallel. There's sort of a time lapse, sort of narrative thing going on in that game. And it allows these cinematics to depict something that is different from what you're doing. So
kind
you don't have that
disassociation.
And I find that really interesting. And I think it's one of the most successful, honestly, like I really think it's one of the most successful game narrative devices ever because one, it doesn't require you to pay any attention to them if you don't want to. I mean, if you can skip them all and have an equally enjoyable time. And if you are interested in it, it provides this entire other level where the little ties in with the Wanderer who kind of scuttles off the screen, and it ties in with the original characters from Diablo 1 in their Nick and I were talking about that today. I mean, I think it's actually pretty masterful in that respect. Yeah. And I'm curious how that.
We got a lot of help from Blizzard South with that, actually. I mean, you'll notice it's also a storyline that can be made totally apart from the actual construction of the game and the cool levels that you go to, and almost with wanton disregard for the you know, the game itself, which was convenient because it could be done with help from guys down south.
And it's the same reason you don't have to pay attention to it if you don't want to.
Right, exactly. Exactly. No, it worked out. It worked out great. I think Chris Metz and Eric was the main inspiration there, so props to him for sure. Big time.
Good job pulling that all together. I talk about that all the time with people because I still feel like that's such a missed opportunity that other games could do and just don't. And I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, if it's done, it's usually a cutscene that's depicting something that is going on parallel to what you're doing, but also in reaction to what you're doing, rather than just separate story.
Almost every game cutscene is in reaction to what you're doing.
Yeah.
I like that the Diablo 2 story keeps chugging along. It matters that you're there because you're reacting to this thing, but it's not reacting to you. I mean, it's this guy
who's
doing this thing, and he's going to do it. And you've got to sort of pick up the pieces, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's very cool.
I don't know how much longer we should go on. It's late at night and we're keeping you here. I don't know if, Nick, you had any other questions?
Nothing crazy major. No.
Jake wanted to say a thing.
I got so much to say. But I'm sorry that I've just sat here next to you listening.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for coming out.
Hey, thank you. Thank you guys.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Very enjoyable. I like to sit around and talk games for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Best of luck with Torchlight. Everyone should buy Torchlight.
They should.
I really honestly believe that. You should buy this game.
Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Well, we will.
Thanks for sitting on the couch over there. Yeah.
All right.
Cool. All right. Cool.
Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
Thanks.
Yeah, that Diablo story was just an amazing coincidence that it kind of fell together and worked out so well. At times, we were thinking the Blizzard film department down south would send us these movies.
It has nothing to do with our damn game at all.
But then it was like Cocktail Dwarf is running through the scene.
Right.
What was that? Cocktail Midgets. We had to have those.
Some people in the company at Blizzard North were kind of pissed. They were like, why aren't they making more?
But like you say, it was perfect because it didn't interfere with your game at all. There's nothing you could do that would ruin the story, and the story wasn't constraining you into doing things that were done.
You don't have the problem where the Cocktail Dwarf in the cutscene looks better than the Cocktail Dwarf in the game, because there isn't, you know what I mean?
Right.
One there.
Yeah. No, totally. Yeah.
The biggest problem with cutscenes that are simply like interstitial to what you're doing is that all of a sudden your guy does a kickflip or something, and it's like, well, I can't do that. Like, that sucks. Like, what do you mean? My character can't do that. Yeah, there's no button for it.
That's way cooler than the game itself.
But you don't have that problem when it's just different characters. I find that very intriguing.
Yeah,
it worked out. Kind of a happy coincidence, and everybody was happy in the long run. But
they were also really good. So everyone's first reaction was, "Whoa, that looks cool!" And then the second was like, "What does that have to do with our game?"
Well, I remember the first time I saw that Diablo 2 trailer. Right, I mean, it was just like Jesus Christ! I'm like, what?
Yeah,
with like the flames and the skeletons. That was the Diablo 1 trailer I'm thinking of actually. God, that was a long time
ago. I mixed them up in my head.
Well, there was the one that was just Diablo like the Dutch angle and the skeletons coming in.
That was
Diablo 1. That
was awesome. Also done pretty much after we were done with the game. They threw a bunch of stuff together at the last minute. But it helped set the scene again.
Sell the mood, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No Cinemax this time. Again, we're stripped down to the bone on this guy.
We narrowed the screen a little for our cinematic sequences in game and pretended to move
that first. That's so funny how much of a standard that's become.
I always think of Zelda 64 for that, but someone probably did it before that.
That's a good example.
That is a good example.
Some of the Final Fantasies did that.
Making that camera noise. It's Zelda whenever you like crawl into a tunnel, it goes beep.
Yeah.
I guess that means I can't do anything.
Watch it happen now.
Yeah. Take a sip of the drink.
I've never seen a podcast happen before, so it's kind of
really? Well, there you go.
I do most people. Most people don't actually ever see Eric, so this is a rare.
I'm in a dark room.
Do you believe he exists?
To prove that we did this. Let's take a quick camera picture.
We use our best.
Yes,
best photographic equipment.
Probably not an average podcast. Yeah.
So. No, we're not.
So just the two of you guys and me in this.
And the four of you guys instead. Video game. So how is this for a neighborhood to live in? It's kind of scary out there sometimes.
Yeah, it's all right. It depends which way you walk, right? I mean, if you go one direction, it's
which direction you choose to walk 15 feet.
If it's like you can go down Hay Street, and then it's like
Hayes Valley, nice shops,
yeah, and restaurants, yeah, and
antiques, and restaurants. Yeah, and then you walk the other direction, and it's like Market Street. Got bums here. Like, that's all we got, bums. But I know I'm fine with it.